To read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show. Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel and inspire you to finish your book. I'm Mark DeVoe.
And I am Mark Stay. And welcome. Our episode this week is sponsored by our patrons, our wonderful Patreon supporters. They are the best. They are the most awesome people, the most engaged writers out there, and we love them all, including our newest patron, Scott Jarrell. Welcome, Scott. If you come over to our Patreon page, you will find all sorts of extras that you can get, not least our deep dive episodes. We're coming up to about 50 deep dive episodes now. That's 50 extra hours of material for you all if you are one of our Patreon supporters. And not only that, if you're a chart topper supporter, you get the episodes early. You get membership to our exclusive and private Bestseller Experiment Writers Group on Facebook, which is just amazing. You also get to ask our interviewers questions before anyone else. And we have the live show, and we also have our one-page punch-ups. Now, submissions have just closed for this round of one-page punch-ups. That's where we take one page from your work in progress. We give it to a top editor, and they give you the most amazing feedback. And this will be our third round. I'm recording that in a week or so, and that will make for a very special episode soon. The other thing as well, if you listen to the deep dives, you'd have heard we just launched a wonderful episode with Simon Appleton from Bookswarm. Bookswarm is, now lots of people do web development, they'll do websites for people. Very few people do them for authors. Simon does them specifically for authors, and he's just fantastic. And he's given our Patreon supporters a wonderful sort of cheat sheet on online marketing and running your website. And he's also giving our listeners a chunky discount on his services. This is the kind of thing that we offer to our patrons. So pop over to bestsellerexperiment.com/support, and you'll find more details there. Get involved.
Hey. Amazing stuff. And talking of special episodes, well, we got a special episode coming up quite soon, haven't we? A rather large number.
Big number. 200.
God, could you believe it?
The nude episode.
Who'd have thought?
Yes.
Live and nude from YouTube. That'll be the final episode of the Best Seller Experiment.
On my to-lose list, isn't it? Yeah. Actually,
you could do the whole kind of nude from the kind of shoulders up, though, right? It's only headshots.
Oh, you don't even want to see that. Not in my condition.
But I don't know, I've been working out. I've been working out for a year for this episode, Mark. Speedos on. Be rocking and rolling, ready to go. No, you're right. People don't want to see that.
They really
okay,
don't want
if
that.
You don't want to see us naked on episode 200, sign up to Patreon. We need 500 Patreon supporters to not be naked.
That's
on episode 200.
That is just blackmail. That's
it
wrong.
It is blackmail, but you know, gotta have some fun. No, but so yeah, we're hoping to get a special guest. Can't really reveal too much at the moment, but it's a big number for us. And as we say to everyone who writes a book, celebrate every word, celebrate every page, celebrate every chapter, celebrate every book you finish. So we're going to celebrate our 200th episode because it's quite an achievement considering this is really just a bit of a fun and games when we first started out, wasn't it?
Well, I didn't think we'd get beyond the first year. I didn't think we'd get beyond the first 6 months, you know.
No.
So to get, and to have kept it going, I mean, one of the reasons I've kept it going, and we'll talk about this more in the social media at the end of the show, because we do a little roundup at the end of the show, is because we hear about success stories from our listeners. And every week we have a new story. We have a new listener who has achieved some kind of incredible milestone, and they've been inspired by the authors we've had on the show, the stuff that they've heard. And that's why we keep it going, because it warms our little hearts, doesn't it?
It does. It's probably the most, there's so many little things that make such huge differences in this world. I think we know that as writers. We talked about that last week's show, didn't we? About being able to sign your first book and sniff your first pages when it turns up. But you know, there's little things as well in life that they may seem at the time when somebody hears something. We're going to talk about this actually in our interview, funnily enough. We've got just to talk about how we continue to deliver with big authors. We've got an author today on the show who sold over 10 million copies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely nuts. But in that interview that you'll hear coming up very shortly, he talks about one moment that changed his life. And I would I'd like to thank everyone that reaches out to us to tell us about their successes for two reasons. Number one, because it does really make this podcast worthwhile to everyone out there. We love to hear about it. It's the most favourite thing in the world, those emails we get. But number two, it's your opportunity to celebrate. And sharing it with us is an opportunity for us to talk about it on the show, celebrate it with this incredible community of hundreds of thousands of writers that we reach out to with this podcast. And, you know, I think generally people are really bad at celebrating those moments. So tell us what's gone on in your life. Tell us how this podcast has inspired you. Maybe tell us of a moment. We love it when we hear of a specific thing that you heard on this show. Maybe an author told you something that just made you stop and have to write something down. We've had people stop in cars, haven't we, on journeys? Mm. Hopefully no accidents. Yeah. But, you know, if there was a moment on this show so far, a line that was said by someone, tell us what it was and we'll broadcast it out. And obviously we'd love to promote your book as well, whatever's happening in your world. So talking about what's happening in our worlds, Mark, what's been happening in the last couple of weeks for you? Anything exciting to report?
Well, I'm working on a new screenplay project with John Wright, and John and I worked on Robot Overlords together, and we outlined the story of this new horror film together.
Made you want to do horror? That's a really interesting decision.
This is how John and I started out. We started out writing horror movies together. It's just none of them actually got made.
Right.
But we love horror. We both love horror. It's one of those genres where people either embrace it or they'll go, I don't like horror, I don't like being scared. Yeah. Or other people just find it completely cathartic. And I totally get that. You either enjoy it or you don't. But it's when you go to festivals like Fright Fest, which is the horror film festival in London every August. It's just wonderful. I've said this many, many times. People who make horror movies are the nicest people, I think, because they get it all out of their system. It's a great cathartic process. And
it's
and
all
this
done,
thing,
isn't it?
This, John and I outlined the story. I'm writing the screenplay my own, but we had a wonderful story session where I came with five ideas, he came with five ideas, and we whittled through them, and we picked one idea that we're running with at the moment, and it is very cathartic because it touches on some troublesome times I had in the last few years and digs very, very deep. I won't say anything more than that, but it's personal. But I also wrote one of the goriest things I've written in years. It's just wonderful. Buckets of blood. So it's very...
They're going to have to get a very large catch-up budget for the movie, for series, if ever it's made.
And I tell you what, it's been... Because I finished a first draft of my novella and I've given it to a beta reader who's given me some fantastic notes, but I'm letting it sit to one side while I finish the first draft of this script. And I'm getting up early and I'm finishing usually somewhere between 11 and noon every day. And it's
nothing like a bit of horror at 5 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, mate. it's been like waking from a dream. It's the most wonderful experience. It's because I'm just shutting everything off. One of the best things I've done in the last month is turn off social media notifications on my phone. Because even if you've got the phone on silent, whenever you pick the phone up, there's a dozen or so notifications. You think, oh, I need to check that. And that just pops you. Even if you get to think, I'm going to do that 2 hours from now, it pops your bubble. I've just been submerged in this world and it really helps the writing. I've no idea if it's any good or not. Funnily enough, the other thing we're doing, which John and I have never done before, because John isn't writing it, I'm writing it, but I'm sending in the pages every day. So I'm sending him a little PDF saying, okay, here are today's pages. And this is what, you know, this is similar to the way that we worked on Back to Reality. And it's kind of scary because you kind of worry that, oh, but it's great because it's, so far the feedback has been, this is brilliant, this is great, keep going. Maybe we need to move that a bit later. Maybe we need to move that, but just keep going. So I'm making really good progress on it. It makes a difference,
doesn't it? Having somebody running alongside you. It's a bit like I was at an athletics meet this weekend with the kids. It was really great fun. And I loved seeing all the parents standing on the inside of the track where they're not meant to be because they're doing javelin. It could turn into quite a horror story in itself. But they're standing on the inside of the track and they're like running alongside their 8-year-old children saying, come on, keep going. You know, they're just about to die. on the track, and it's because the parents are there just encouraging them. And I think having that running mate, there's a good analogy, a running mate. So maybe we should all find that person. I mean, we had each other obviously when we wrote Back to Reality, but I'm thinking about our listeners. Who do you have as that person that might run alongside you? And it doesn't have to be an editor. It could just be, you know, it could just be an encouraging friend. Now, this is always a dangerous area to go with friends, because we know that friends and family are one of two beasts. They're either incredibly encouraging, no matter how bad anything you write is, or they are incredibly critical. They tell you how it is. Yeah. And then it hurts twice as bad because you've got all the emotional connections with them, and then you end up falling out and never speaking again. But I wonder if everyone could find themselves over the next few weeks or months. It's a bit like the Julie we talked about earlier, didn't we? It's to find that person who will encourage you. And I think sometimes there's just a space for encouragement, not necessarily criticism. That can come. That there's going to be plenty of that down the road from editors and publishers and readers on Amazon. But maybe when you're just trying to get the book finished, it's about having someone who will read it alongside you and not necessarily give you feedback, but just kind of encourage you to keep going. What would that be? We need to come up with a term. Maybe our listeners can come up with a term for what that... I mean, we call it our Julie, right? Inspired from a previous episode. But I wonder if there's a kind of a technical term we can come up with that can get out into the writing community. What could it be, Mark? Any ideas?
Well, I like the idea of running mate. And, of course, in a gym you have a spotter, don't you?
A spotter, yeah.
So maybe something around that. I mean, for me, it keeps me writing every day. And I don't want to let John down. You know, I want to deliver this for him. And
that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's I don't want to disappoint him. So it is keeping that, again, it's like that public declaration that we talk about
it
so
is.
Often. It's keeping me on my toes.
And it's all the beauty of it without actually having a co-author. How wonderful is that, Mark? No, you don't want to do it like that. You want to do it like this.
I'll still get that. Don't worry. I'll still get that.
Of course you do. But I think, I think that's a really interesting, because we just started to touch on this, but I think we're onto something here. I think this is we talk a bit about this, but give us some examples of people in your life. So if you're listening to the podcast, if you have that person that we're talking about, tell us who they are. Tell us how they encourage you, because you could inspire other people. If you share it on our Facebook page or Twitter, for example, you could inspire some of other writers to reach out to maybe somebody in their social circle. It might be someone in your book club, for example. It might be an old English teacher. I mean, who knows? There's someone in everyone's life who's there who'd love to be your running mate. So let us know who they are and inspire us by what they do to make your life more productive writing, and what they'd, like Mark says, inspire you to kind of keep on delivering those words. It's a really interesting idea. It's fantastic stuff. Now, talking of incredible authors though, Mark, we have got an incredible author on the show today, and when you told me he had sold over 10 million copies, I mean, it's really interesting, because there's so much in this interview that I found really surprising for somebody who's sold so many. He seems to break a lot of the, or doesn't do a lot of the things that we talk about, and yet still had this incredible success, which I find very encouraging.
Yeah.
But tell us a bit about our amazing author today on the show.
Well, I was delighted to speak to Simon Beckett, who is a best-selling thriller author. In 2009, he was the UK's top-selling author in Europe, and his books have sold over 10 million copies worldwide, translated into 29 languages. He's you'll hear this in the interview. His career has not been this, you know, giant upward arrow to success. There have been all sorts of ups and downs, including a moment where basically he thought, this is it, I'm probably never going to be published again, which is just fascinating. But like I say, there was one moment that changed everything for him. But he's been a journalist as well, and he talks about his research in some depth as well, because he likes to get his hands dirty. He's gone out on police drug raids. He's been to, you know, gone with vice units to brothels. He's you know, seen gunfights, and he's also been to a body farm, and he'll talk about that as well. So, and as you say, he doesn't, you know, there are no absolutes, there are no rules in any of this, but it's quite an unconventional story. And he's such a modest guy as well. Such a modest guy. It's you'd never know that he'd sold 10 million copies.
I know. It's fantastic. So,
it was a delight to speak to him.
Brilliant. Let's dive in now, listening to Mark interviewing Simon Beckett.
Simon, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. We're fascinated about your new book, The Scent of Death, but we're also fascinated about where it all started for you. You've been writing for quite some time now, haven't you, Simon?
I have, yes. Since the 1990s, I've had a few psychological thrillers published back then. But the David Hunter series, that's more recent, and that came about. I was working as a freelance journalist, and I got a commission to go to a place called the Body Farm in Tennessee, which back then was the only place in the world that used actual human cadavers to research decomposition. And I was commissioned to go over there and follow a group of American police officers being trained on how to process crime scenes that had been staged using real human bodies. So that was a little bit different for me, but that formed the inspiration of the series of, you know, the David Hunter series, who is a British forensic anthropologist. And I based a lot of particularly the first book on what I'd seen over there, but transposed it to the UK.
You've written a couple of amazing blog posts about your trip to this body farm, and listeners, we'll put some links in the show notes for you so you can check these out. But this was, would it be fair to say that your writing career could be split into before and after David Hunter? Because David Hunter came out of this trip to the body farm, and you've had amazing best-selling novels ever since. Would that be fair?
Yeah, completely fair. Career changing. I'd not had a book published for about 6 or 7 years, something like that. I was always trying and wanting to, you know, to do something else, but I'd no idea if I was going to make it back, you know, get anything back in. Certainly not a book back in print anyway. So it changed everything. So from one journalistic commission, it was a week well spent, let's put it that way.
Now, if you've gone 6 or 7 years without being published, you're kind of in the wilderness there. Were you ever thinking, well, this is it, I have my shot, let's move on? Or were you always writing and always determined to get back into the game?
A bit of both, really. I was always writing and always determined to try and get back in the game, but I was by no means certain that it was going to happen. Not by that time. I mean, I'd had, you know, some successes as well, but not for a while. And I'd been one knock back after another, really. And you've got to be realistic in that position and think, yeah, okay, it might not happen, in which case I would have continued making a living as a freelance journalist. But at the same time, I knew that if I didn't try and carry on writing and, you know, keep working at it, that writing novels, I should say, that it wasn't going to happen anyway. So the only way it was going to happen was if I keep telling you that we have to persevere with it, which I did. And I got lucky.
And I'm guessing if this is sort of late 90s, early 2000s, self-publishing wasn't really the thing it is now, is it?
Not really, no. But when I went to the body farm, it was in 2002, and I mean, now it's an accepted, route into getting your work seen. But it wasn't then at all. So it wasn't really an option at all. So it was either hoping that you could get something picked up, or if not, you just had to keep on trying. So it was a different situation back then, yeah.
I'd love to talk more about the body farm in just a moment, but I was looking through some of your tweets and some of your blogs, and I was fascinated to notice that there's some writers that have an office in the house. Some writers might have a shed at the bottom of the garden. Yours is a bit of a walk away, isn't it? Yours is about a 30-minute walk away.
It is. I mean, I do have a small sort of study thing in the house. We moved recently, but I used to, where we used to live, I've got a very, very small area, and the washing machine used to be in there, and the cupboard, you know, cupboards with all the household stuff. So, you know, every now and again, I'd be trying to write to my wife and come and wheel the chair backwards on its casters so she could get to, you know, something in the cupboard. So it became, you know, we did sort of like think, well, you know, what can we do here? And made the decision that it would be an investment if I could actually get somewhere where I could get out of the house and lock myself away. So, it paid dividends really, because when I'm down there, there's no internet, there's no landline, and even the mobile reception is not that brilliant. So there's not a great deal else to do in there apart from ride. So when I go down there, I've got no excuse not to get something done.
And it's about a 30-minute walk away. And I remember in one of your blogs, you were saying that's important thinking time, isn't it? Is it all about getting into a state of mind?
It is, because for me it is. I mean, every writer's going to approach things differently. And I know, you know, not everybody's got a bolt hole they can go to. And, I haven't always. But I think sometimes just being able to sort of like, you know, get out on the street, I used to enjoy running, but my knees packed in. So it's still a little bit of a way of getting out, a change of scenery, and you can sort of, breathe a bit of fresh air try and get yourself set for doing some work.
Absolutely. Anything has to be better than trying to write while the washing machine is on the spin cycle, really, as well.
Well, yes, quite.
Okay. Had you always wanted to write from childhood? Was there a moment where you thought, this is it, this is what I want to do?
It had always been there, but I'd wanted to do other things as well. So it was always something I really enjoyed from being a kid, the writing stories at school, and then even at A-level, there was an option added, creative writing option, which again I enjoyed. But I was all set to be a biochemist at one bit and then failed biology and chemistry A-level, so ended up taking an English degree by default, by accident, I should say. I got creative writing option to it as well, and I really enjoyed that. But by the, I was still struggling to, I got to the end of it and I couldn't really see how I was going to make a living doing that. So for years I ended up doing other things, but it was always there at the back of my mind. And I made a decision. I was going to, I was in my late 20s, that I was going to try and make a go of it. And then coincidentally, I got a friend of mine who was working as an English school in Spain, teaching English as a foreign language, phoned up and said they got a vacancy, was interested. So at that time, I was making a living, working outside, doing sort of building work and that sort of thing. And it seemed an attractive proposition, so I sung the hook over there, and with a view to trying to make a go of writing, because I was only working in the evening, so I got all day to do something else, and I started making a conscious effort then, a deliberate try at it. And that was when it started, and about 7 or 8 years later I managed to get something published.
Right, yeah, a mere 7 or 8 years overnight success.
Yeah.
I'm interested that you're doing jobs like, say, you're working and building and such, because that real life, that's essential for a writer, isn't it? A little bit of real life, a little bit of getting your hands dirty and meeting the public and,
I don't think it hurts. It gives you a bit more of a perspective. I spent years working outdoors on a ladder, which in winter isn't a lot of fun. And days when the writing's not going well, I do try and remind myself that it's better than that. At least I'm in a nice warm office. I think it is. It broadens your perspective, and even if it's not something you enjoy doing at the time. And you never know when you write. I mean, some of the things, one of my novels, not one of the David Hunter ones, one of the standalones, was about a character who ends up sort of renovating and repointing an old farmhouse in France. And I'd done similar sort of work to that myself and worked off rickety scaffolding. So you never know what's going to come in handy.
Let's talk about David Hunter, because Scent of Death is the sixth book, the sixth David Hunter thriller. It all began with The Chemistry of Death. I think the series character, particularly for crime, if you get that right, you hit the jackpot, I think, and you definitely have here with the string of bestsellers. Was there a feeling when you came across David Hunter as a character, when you were creating him, were you thinking, this is it, this is, I've got it right, there's something different about this one?
No, not at all, unfortunately. would have helped my confidence writing. It was just, as I said, I was, it was after being to the body farm, and I was still working as a freelance journalist when I was trying to, develop the idea and write the Chemistry of Death. And you wanted something a little bit different. I didn't want him to be a sort of, hard drinking investigator or a police officer. I knew I wanted, you know, yeah, him to be different in that respect, but I had no idea if it was going to get published or not. And so it was just a case of writing the sort of story I would have enjoyed reading myself, and try and enjoy writing it and making it scary, which was something else I wanted to do. I wanted to make it unpredictable, but twisting that people wouldn't see coming. And the main thing I wanted to do with David Hunter was to make him a sympathetic character, somebody that, you know, was in a lot of ways quite an ordinary man who'd just had, because before the series starts, he's had a personal tragedy which has sort of derailed him. And when we see him, he's having a rough time trying to come to terms with everything. And I just wanted to write a character that readers would feel, you know, they wanted to spend time in his company.
Well, that certainly worked. But so there was no master plan, because sometimes you hear people go, particularly you get this in, because I write in science fiction and fantasy, and you get this a lot, and then people go, oh, I've got a 7-series book series. It's all mapped out in my head. I know exactly where it's going. There was no master plan. You were just focused on making that first book as good as it could
be. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, my career has been, you know, I don't think, and not just a master plan, there's not many plans will stop. It's, I seem to have stumbled into it from fairly those A-levels all those years ago, really. But there was no master plan like that. I didn't know it was going to be a series, until it was actually picked up by publishers. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said, and of course, you know, you are planning on writing a series. And I said, yeah, you know, of course I am. And I said, okay, I'm going to have to get busy on the next one now. So that actually created a few problems, because I got to decide then. I've played in bands, none of them are successful, but you hear with musicians, it's that second album syndrome. And right. I think that can apply for writers as well. It certainly did for me, because it's then, even though I'd written books before, writing the second one in the series, you think, I was very conscious of that. The first one, I'd written it out pressure. You know, I didn't know if it was going to get picked up or not. The second one, by now, you know, I was in a publishing contract. You want things to continue. You want it to do well. And suddenly you've got to make decisions about which direction you're going to be taking the character in. And so then by the time I came to write the second book, it was a case that I've got to start really scratching my head and deciding where I was going to be heading with it.
Yeah, that's interesting, because like you say, we've heard about that second book syndrome a lot, because a lot of people will spend years and years and years writing that first book to get it perfect, and suddenly you've got to deliver book two in just 12 months. And of course, you've got that difficult decision. Do I stick with this character? Is this going to send me down a blind alley, or is this the, you know, the road to success? So were there publishers and agents egging you on, trying to get more David Hunter from you?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I mean, it was assumed that I was, you know, I was going to write a series. And to be honest, having, you know, spent years in the wilderness, as we said earlier, I wasn't going to look a gift horse in the mouth. So I was, you know, damn sure I was going to try and make the most of it. But it was still that question that, you know, of where I go with it, because without giving anything away to people who've not read it, at the end of the chemistry of death, David Hunter's working as a GP, he's given up being a forensic anthropologist, and he's sort of pulled back into it because of a murder that he's involved with. By the second novel, I then got to decide, well, is he still going to be a GP? Is he still going to be in the same, you know, Norfolk village, which was a sort of like remote backwater at the time, or do I move things on? Do I try and change the situation? Do I make him a forensic anthropologist? Do I move him away from there? And eventually that was a decision I took, and I think it was the right one. But at the time, I wasn't sure how people would react to it. And again, I try and change, vary the forensics in the book. So the first one was based on what I'd seen in Tennessee. Now, Tennessee was, you know, it's hot, it's humid. And so that's one sort of environment you don't really get very much in the UK. So Norfolk, the Norfolk Broads was the closest I could come to Tennessee in a high unnaturally hot summer. But I didn't want to do the same thing. You know, I knew I couldn't do the same thing again. So the second novel, I set it on a Scottish island, which, again, as a journalist, I'd been going to one or two, you know, doing stories in these places. So I knew a bit about them. And I decided to make it more about fire deaths instead. And that sort of made a few people askance. I can remember one publisher sort of like said, but what about the maggots? And so sort of admit that, no, there weren't going to be any maggots in the second one. But, you know, hopefully people would like it anyway. And, yeah, they seemed to.
It's fascinating that you moved location, because so often, particularly if you have a serious character, they tend to be focused in one city, one location, and they become associated with that location as much as the character. But you location is important to you, but you move David around, don't you?
I do, yeah. I mean, the location is hugely important, but again, I decided that was something else I decided after the same one, because a lot of forensic experts, you know, he's a police consultant, and a lot of the, you know, the forensic anthropologists and other forensic experts I've spoken to who do this consultancy work travel all over the place. You know, they don't tend to just base themselves in their own area. They will go, you know, if they'll get me phoned up and say, oh, can you come out to X, Y, Z, you know, different police forces all over the country. And on the one hand, that's good, because you can build an entirely new setting, you know, different themes brought into it. And I also like the idea because David Hunter is quite a loner. Mm. And so each book, really, he finds himself in a new situation with a completely new set of characters, which then he has to, you know, everybody has to sort out the pecking order and get used to the new relationships, which dramatically is good. It does make life a little more difficult, because you've not got that cushion in some of the later ones. It comes in a little bit, but you've not got that same cushion of having a lot of familiar characters that you can bring in and play with, because each book was just basically David Hunter in a new location with a new cast of characters. Right. So, it seemed to work.
That's great, because that is, you're right, you are sacrificing that sort of band of characters beneath him. But because we often ask, particularly crime writers, when they're writing a series character, what do you do to keep the character fresh? But I guess if you're moving him to a new place with new colleagues to interact with, and perhaps, you know, rub up the wrong way or whatever, or conflict with, that's your drama every time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, And it, you know, you're not restricted. You can change things around a little bit more, and you know, if it's all in the same city or whatever. So as I said, I think that there's always going to be drawbacks whichever route you go. But I think for me, it felt like the right decision to take, and it was a good way of Hunter just finding his way into these new investigations.
Excellent stuff. And now that you're 6 books into the David Hunter series,
yes.
Is there more of a master plan? Is there, or are you still sort of maybe just one book ahead of the game?
There's a little bit more of a master plan, a plan at least, because what I tend to do now is when I'm writing one book, I'm already thinking about the next one. And to some extent, I'm sort of teeing things up, certainly in my own mind, as to what I'm doing next. When I first started out with this, and then, as I said earlier, because after the Chemistry of Death, I didn't know it was going to be a series, so I had no idea what I was going to do for the second one. And that was a bit of a problem I had, because I'd get to the end of one of the books and then think, OK, now what? Because it was a completely new start. I mean, although there's a series, and yes, there are sort of like plot threads and things that run throughout, each book is meant to stand alone, and they work as standalones. So there was that aspect to start off with when, you know, you get to the end of one and then you think, okay, I better reinvent the wheel again now and start again from scratch. Now I've sort of, as I say, I try and put a few things in place so when I finish one, I can springboard onto the next one, which makes my life a little easier.
And there's more of this interview over on Patreon. Here are some highlights. And most people go to Tennessee, they might go to the Jack Daniels Brewery or go for a nice meal or see some history.
Yeah.
You were digging up bodies that have been in the ground for 6 months. But this...
Yeah, pretty much. So it was different. Yeah, it was different.
But, that one moment that changed Simon's life. You know, there's a story in everyone's trajectory, isn't there?
Hmm.
But what a bizarre moment.
Yeah.
When you know, I'll get an idea for a scene, and I'll drop an email to one or two people and say, you know, what would happen in such and such a situation? Could it happen in this way? And then depending on what they say, you either go in one direction or another. And that continues all the way through. And by the time I get to the end, I'm generally checking things until just before the final proofs go off.
We are going to do a bit of writing coaching, something I'm going to be contributing towards a podcast, and it's going to be around all of this stuff. So if you want to get involved in that, if you think, well, actually, this could be really, really helpful, you know what we're going to say, don't you? You have to sign up to Patreon.
Because at a technical level, how do you prepare for your research? Do you essentially have a list of questions that you're looking for answers, or do you tie it to specific moments in the book? And when you speak to people, do you record it, or do you make notes as you go?
You talk about the idea of images. I mean, in coaching, we talk about things called vision boards. Have you heard of vision boards before?
What I don't want to do is to end up making things into a sort of a travelogue.
Yes.
When I wrote the chemistry of death, somebody emailed said, oh, I know exactly the train station that you're talking about, where that David Hunter gets off. I know it. I've been there myself. And he's thinking, well, I have, because I'd made it up. But I'd made it up based on actual places I've been and I'd seen. And I think I'm a great believer in sort of borrowing bits from real life and then mixing them with imagination and creating something that is sort of fictitious.
Here are some clips from this week's deep dive episode of the Bestseller Experiment for Patreon subscribers.
David Bishop, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today, sir?
I'm not bad. Thank you for having me.
Our absolute pleasure. I thought it would be fantastic to get you on to talk about writing for comics. And as I discovered, you've also written for radio, you've written for nonfiction, you've written pretty much everything, haven't you?
Yeah, written for TV, radio dramas. Yeah. Audio dramas. I've just got a Doctor Who audio original has just come out. 20 novels published, non-fiction books.
Fantastic.
Comics, graphic novels, computer games. It's a very particular set of craft skills, not to get all Liam Neeson on it. but the nature of it, it's halfway between prose fiction and screen fiction. So it's got a lot in common with screenwriting in terms of the concision you need to have, the power of the visual imagination, that's very important. Also the fact that a script for comics is an industrial document, just as a screenplay is. It's a blueprint for somebody else to bring their creativity to the narrative.
As I've heard Alan Moore say that, he says it's what happens between the panels that's important. But is it also that juxtaposition of the two images together? Is that how people read comics?
Oh, absolutely. From one panel to the next is like a cut in a film. My favourite John Wagner panel description was dread, headshot, grim. And that was the whole panel description. Most people can identify the symptoms of a problem in a story because I go, I'm bored, I don't believe this, I'm confused. It's one of those three things is normally what will go wrong in a story for a reader. Bored, confused, my suspension of disbelief has just left the building.
Finally, let's talk about writing for audio, because this is something you've been writing for Big Finish Productions, who do most fantastic audio dramatisations, and you've been working on Sarah Jane Smith and Doctor Who and Judge Dredd. What are the challenges of writing for audio?
I mean, it's very similar to writing for radio drama, which I've done a little bit of that as well, in that you have to think about how is the story going to be communicated.
You can help support the podcast. Subscribe today at bestsellerexperiment.com/support. That's bestsellerexperiment.com/support. Thanks again.
So, Mark, what's happening on social media this week?
Oh, we've had all sorts of great news. Now, the first bit of great news. Now, you know how we love a listener success story. Well, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago that Lorna Cook's book, The Forgotten Village, was doing rather well in the on Amazon and on Kindle. Well, just this week, she has shot up to number 20 in the overall paid Kindle store. In the UK.
Wow.
Number 20. She's number one in historical romance, number one in European history, number one in romantic suspense. She's got 68 customer reviews, an average of 4.7 out of 5. So this is incredible. Just amazing. Lorna will be on the show in a few weeks. We've got such a backlog of episodes to get through, but Lorna will be on the show. I'm going to do a little follow-up episode as well. I'm going to speak to Lorna because we recorded it so long ago before the book came out. I'm going to do a little follow-up where I say to her, you know, wow, what's it been like? Tell us about
your
experience.
That's cool. The before and after. I like it.
Yeah,
exactly, that's great. Exactly. Oh, congratulations, Lorna. And Lorna's been with us from the beginning, pretty much. hasn't she?
Pretty much, I think. You know, so it's a great, great story. We've had one of our listeners, his book is out today. You remember we spoke about Sam Anthony's novel, The Adulterous Handbook. It had those sort of basic instinct colours.
I can't forget the cover. It's locked in my mind.
And he did it with De Monza, one of our former sponsors, which was great. So his book is out today. Congratulations on that, Sam. He said, thanks so much for all the advice and encouragement on your excellent podcast. Well, Sam, thank you for listening to us, and we hope it's a smash hit. I'm going to put a link in the show notes for that if folks want to check that out, and they definitely see it. It looks red hot. I tell you, it's so rather
absolutely saucy. Congrats, Sam.
And an amazing bit of news for everyone's favorite bollocker. This came through just before we started recording. Ben Aronovic, who we love deeply, his series, Rivers of London series, which I adore, is just fantastic, is being adapted for television by Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. How about that?
That's just fantastic. Unbelievable.
It is just amazing. It turns out that Nick Frost is a fan, and he picked them up on the holiday and read them, and it's the dream team. It's such a dream team of people.
It is
people.
A dream team.
And it's interesting because so many things are coming to an end. You know, this year we've seen the last of the big Avengers movies, that phase of Avengers. You know, Star Wars Episode 9 is coming out. Game of Thrones is coming to an end. And I'm kind of scouring about what's going to be my new big passion. Well, boom, here it is, Rivers of London. Obviously, very early days yet, but I think he could not have asked for a better team to put this together. I think he's in very, very safe hands. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens with that.
Absolutely. And we should put it out there as well that, Simon, Nick, if you're listening to the Bestseller Experiment, there's a really cool book actually that we came across a few years ago, Mark, didn't we? Called Back to Reality, which might actually be up your street. Which is funny, actually. I think I look at the comedy in Rivers of London, I look at the comedy in our book, and weirdly enough, I mean, this is part of our story. When we put our spreadsheet together at the very beginning of our kind of podcasting world, and we were trying to work out what we were going to write, it was. One of the things that kept coming up was this kind of love of Peg British and comedy and Simon Pegg films and Spaced, wasn't it? Right?
Spaced
was a big one. Spaced. So, that's cool. Maybe there's a kind of weird matrix that's forming around. Ben is the centre of the universe. But congratulations, Ben, though. We're absolutely chuffed for you. That is amazing news.
We got some great news on the public declarations. Poppy T. Perry, who is at Poppy T. Perry on the Twitter, she said, there she is, draft 2 finished and ready to print next week for Beta Eyes, her book Cowbell. I think I'm going to cry happy tears. So much heart and soul goes into these things. Done before my bestseller experiment declaration of 1st of May 2. Whoop! Well, whoop
another
indeed.
Early.
Yeah, fantastic. It's they just amazing news. So big brilliant. Congrats there. Can't wait to see the finished book on the bookshelves. And we've had a declaration from Jeff White, who, again, has been with us for a very long time. Jeff White, he says, I've set myself some deadlines, engaged an editor and commissioned a cover designer, all aiming towards publication by the end of September. Now, we did this on the BXP group. Here's an example of the kind of support you get from the BXP group, because Ian Sainsbury, who has had some great success as a self-published author, he said, I'll do the Mark's job for them, specific deadlines please. And he said, congratulations on taking the step, committing to a daily workout for the first time was what got my novel written. You're on your way. And Jeff White said, okay, my specific deadline is Friday the 27th of September, the last Friday of the month, seems like as good a day as any. I'm nearing the end of my second draft now and decided I need deadlines and targets, otherwise I could waffle on forever. Here we go indeed, Jeff. It's fantastic. In my diary.
Well,
I'll be keeping
Jeff.
A track
Thank
on
you,
that.
Ian, for your support as well. And if you want to be part of the BXP team, it is a very exclusive group of incredible listeners like yourself that love this podcast. And they're doing it by showing their support for us. But what they also get is they get to all come together on a Facebook group every single day, ask daft questions, help each other, inspire each other, share knowledge. It's absolutely incredible. I would go as far as to say it's one of the most powerful groups of writers on the internet, bar none. So if you want to be part of that group, it's very simple. You just go to bestsellerexperiment.com/support. You pledge it to the chart topper level, which is $10 a month to help us do this podcast. And you get access to that group. So go for it.
All fantastic stuff. Come and find us online, folks. We are on Facebook, Bestseller Experiment on Facebook. On Twitter and Instagram, we are at Bestseller XP. And please subscribe, rate, and review on your podcatcher of choice. That really helps us, makes us very visible. And big thanks, as always, to Dave. One thing I must mention, excuse me, regarding Dave. Last week we mentioned the sad passing of Warren Adler, but I also mentioned that he was working on an audio biography. Well, our Dave was involved with that. That's how we heard about Warren and were able to interview him. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes to Dave's, it's on the Warren Adler website where they have those episodes. So if you want to hear Warren's story as audio biography and it's inspirational stuff, check it out there. And it's been edited by Dave, seeing that's going to be a quality product.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And if you have a public declaration for us, if you know that now is the time that you have to get out and declare your writing dream to the world, or at least what your challenge is for the next month or 6 months, come along to the Facebook group, Twitter group, drop us an email, give us your public declaration. We will read it out on the show. And you know what that means? Once it's out there, mm-hmm. you have to deliver. So please get in contact. We love to hear from you. So Mark, thank you so much for today. Brilliant interview, inspiring as ever. And we look forward to you joining us again for another episode next week. And until then, it's a goodbye from Mark 1.
And a goodbye from Mark 2. Goodbye.
Goodbye.